And Brett, thank you so much for joining once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Now, I'm JJ Walsh in Hiroshima, and Brett, where are you? Tell us all.
Yeah, I'm out here in Ojika Island in Nagasaki Prefecture, part of the Goto Archipelago, so kind of off the west coast of Kyushu, for those who aren't familiar with that area.
And Brett, you have lived on that island, you said about 12 years, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll put together about 12 years. There were some kind of back and forths there in the beginning, but yeah.
And how long have you had this passion for fixing up old houses?
Mostly since I came over here to Japan, you know, especially coming to the island. This was the first place that I came to in Japan, aside from 3 nights in Tokyo, and then straight to the island. So came here, and there's so many kominka on this island that immediately I was sort of struck by the, you know, the beauty, and yeah, just really was drawn to the lifestyle that comes with living in a kominka, and the history behind them, and then seeing so many that were being left abandoned and sort of, you know, falling apart and not being cared for. It really sort of encouraged me to want to do something to make them livable again.
Now, we met at the Minka Summit 2 years ago in Hanase Village, Kyoto, and once again we will meet in April this year at the next Hanase Village Minka Summit. And yeah, you are on two panels. One panel is how to find and renovate a minka. Can you give us a little teaser about something you're going to be talking about?
Well, there's just so many aspects to finding and renovating a minka. And I think I'll probably come to it with my personal sort of methodology of restoring the minka, which is to incorporate as much of the sort of traditional features as possible, but also sort of recycling materials, reusing materials, and using the materials that were originally incorporated into the house. So, you know, if you need to do something with a wall, knock it down, take it out, or whatever, my philosophy is to use the sort of traditional technique to build the wall back up. So using earth walls, the bamboo frame, you know, I try to use those natural traditional materials as much as possible. So I think we can get into some of the details about how does that happen? What are the difficulties? What are the, you know, ways that you can make some of those things happen?
That sounds great. And I will be moderating that panel. Mm-hmm. Another panel I'm moderating with you is about how to connect to your minka's legacy. Can you give us a little hint about what you might be talking about on that panel?
Yeah, so that one, you know, there's three other folks that'll be on the panel with me as well, and we've kind of divided up the topics amongst us, and I'll kind of be focusing on what to do with features of a minka that maybe fit sort of a modern lifestyle, but maybe don't fit modern lifestyles anymore. Kind of what to do depending on your situation. You know, if you're living a modern lifestyle, but you're in a minka that has certain features that aren't used anymore, well, what do you do with them? Another topic that I'll be dealing with is kind of finding the details about your minka and how it related to the community that it's in. So there's a number of hints, things that you can ask your neighbors about, you know, trying to get some of the backstory about it. One of the things that I'll talk about is the yago, or the name that most minkas had. And the house that I'm in currently right now has a yago, and kind of lends some hints to its history. The original yago of this house that I'm in right now is Hashinomoto, which basically means like at the foot of the bridge. But currently there's a place where there used to be a small stream running nearby, but there's no bridge here anymore. But it kind of gives you the idea that when this house was constructed back in Meiji, the second year of Meiji, there probably was a bridge, you know, right here crossing the little stream by the house. So that's kind of some interesting details that you can kind of pick up by talking to neighbors nearby or the previous owner or what have you.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think you also talked about community and how you're working on renovating old houses to help people do guest houses and businesses there. Before we started, you were talking about there's 350 empty houses on the island, right?
Yeah, roughly in various states of well, one of the big problems on the island is that there are a lot of empty houses, 350, like we mentioned, but there's almost zero that are in immediately livable condition. So there are a lot of people that want to move out to Ojika. They're really interested in it. They come and visit. They talk to the town office. You know, they talk to community members. And a lot of them are sort of ready to move here, but they just can't find a house that is ready to accept them. And so that's kind of the main focus of my efforts over these years, is trying to make some of these empty minka, you know, just bringing them back up to livable conditions so that people can move back out here, out into the island again.
That's so important. And you were talking about working with other people, collaborating last time we were talking, as well as you mentioned this time you've been doing beach cleanups and joining community efforts there. Living on an island, you seem to get more than your fair share of things washing up, right?
Yeah. Especially, you know, I've been doing it more or less since I moved to the island, and really regularly since 2013, once a month on average. And I've really noticed the amount of trash washing up over that, let's say, 10 or 11 year span. It's increasing every year, the amount of trash that is washing ashore, and the piles at the end of our beach cleanups, you know, the bags of stuff that we've accumulated just keep getting bigger and bigger. So, you know, the more and more we clean up, the more and more washes us ashore. So unfortunately, it's a growing problem still at this point. It's not one that really anywhere seems to have a handle on how to stop this problem. You know, there's talks of the amount of trash in the ocean is doubling at a rate every 7 years. The amount of trash in the ocean is doubling, and that's something that I'm definitely seeing, firsthand.
Well, I really appreciate you guys making the effort, because it's overwhelming, you know, when you do beach cleanups, and it's really important not to ignore that it is happening and to be reminded. Like every time you do a beach cleanup, you're like, I've bought that before, you know, like it's always definitely. Like, I can do better, you know.
And it's it can be easy to sort of get disheartened when you're, you know, you go there and you're, I just cleaned here a month ago and there's all this trash. But it's also a good opportunity, like you say, to sort of reevaluate the way you're living, how you think about things. But it's also a good opportunity to be, even though there's trash on the beach, it still is a beautiful island, and you're still outside in nature, and it can be a really nice time to just, you know, feel the breeze and hear the ocean crashing and be doing a good thing for the earth, you know, while being outside and getting out in nature.
And being a proactive member of your community, right? Mm-hmm. People always talk about that. When you go to live in rural areas, when you take over the minka, you become part of a community. So when you're out there helping each other, it's a great community feel too, right?
Yeah, definitely a great way to get some goodwill with, you know, with those community members that are living nearby.
Absolutely. Now, last time we mentioned as well, you were doing collaborative projects with Kyle and John in Okayama. And it looks like this time too, you went to Okayama to help with some plastering. Is that right?
Yeah, I went to Okayama to do some plastering, but that was just a project on my own. I did go and visit John while I was there. I didn't see Kyle this time, but John and Yamamoto-san's shop is really close by to that place, so went in and had a chat with them. But yeah, just doing some plastering inside there. There's a kind of a funny story with this place that you can see the little doorway in front of where I'm on the ladder there. As soon as I finished going over all of these walls and getting them nice and white plastered, these swallows that live in the section near, just to the side of that got kind of lost and came into the room and started flying around and around and around. And they ended up sort of pooping on my freshly white plastered walls. So that was, yeah, that was a little bit of consternation.
Oh, no. Is plastering, do you enjoy it? I just had a great conversation with Emily Kaneko, who's doing a plastering workshop at the Kaminka Summit. Mm-hmm. Is it one of those things that you enjoy, the kind of the rhythmic meditative style of it?
Yeah, it's totally meditative. It's something that you really get into a rhythm with, and it's something that you can't go too fast. If you want, you know, good results, you have to give it the time that the material wants you to give it, whether that's because it's, you know, you're trying to do it, get a certain finish, or it's the material you're working with, things take different amounts of time to dry. So there's a timing that you need to do certain things at, and you can't really always change that timing. Like if you want to, I don't know what's a good example, but you can't, you know, get a really good finish if you try and rush it and do it while it's still too wet. You know, it'll create lines in the plaster, and if you wait too long and it's too dry, well then, you know, it's already hardening up on you. So I like to sort of get in that rhythm and have a conversation with the with the materials about what it wants to do that day.
That sounds very similar to like what Alex Kerr and so many other people who've worked with old houses always say, is listen to the house, right? Mm-hmm. Listen to your materials. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, whether it's carpentry or plastering or, you know, any number of those sort of traditional crafts or skills, the listening to the materials is a really integral part in it. You know, what if it's a carpenter, you know, reading the way that the material you know, may want to bend over the years, or like plastering, how it's going to dry, how it's going to finish. Yeah, there's always these little things that you kind of have to listen to the materials that day.
Yeah,
it might be different, you know, from one day to next.
Yeah. Now, you're often working with wood. You gave me some pictures of a deck project you did. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is at a house that I helped out. The first sort of big project where I did the whole house, and John and Kyle also came, you know, to help out with sections on it for me. But then the friends of mine that are living in that house and doing a kind of homestay thing just had a new baby, and they wanted to put a deck on the front of the house so they'd have some, you know, space for lounging around and playing with the newborn outside in front there. So yeah, so I built that deck for them, and as I usually do or always do, I did it without, or, you know, sort of utilizing traditional joinery techniques. And yeah, I don't use nails if they're not needed, other than, you know, nailing the deck planks on there. But yeah, I like to try and do things with the traditional style and use the joinery. So
that's so beautiful. Is that what we're looking at now? So you would mark it and then carve it and then fit it. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. So this is the Sumizuke, and you can see the Sumisashi tool. So, am I still not connected?
I can hear you again.
Okay.
Yeah, now it's better.
All right. Yeah, so this is a tool made out of bamboo that's traditionally used for marking the sumi, the ink lines. And one side is it's sort of flared out like this and is cut at an angle. And that's what you use to sort of draw the sharp lines that you see, which indicate where I'm going to cut. And then the other end is you kind of smash it with a hammer, and it turns into almost exactly like a brush that you would use for calligraphy. And that's how you write you can see the little like kind of curved marks on there that are indicating, okay, you dig out on the inside of these lines. That's the part that gets taken away. And then you might also, you know, use it to write instructions or traditionally houses, each post in the house has a banzuke, an indicator, a character on it that tells you exactly what position in the house that piece of wood is going to be at, so that you can keep track of where everything goes and how it connects together. Yeah, and so then I do the joinery mostly by hand, although I've started, there's so many projects going on that I have started to use more electric tools to kind of speed up the process. But one of the things that I did an Instagram post about this too, that one of the things that I was reluctant to use electric tools for was that I didn't want to use sort of dirty power. And so I finally got a solar setup in my workshop. And so now I'm 100% solar powered in all of the, you know, all of the tools that I use.
That's awesome. That's really good.
Happy about
total green builder.
Yeah.
And then you stained it. You stained the wood?
This is just kakishibu. So yeah, it's a traditional natural. It's just fermented persimmon juice. And when you put it, you know, this is probably 2 coats, and then you leave it out in the sun for a while and it turns this really nice, rich kind of amber color. Oh,
that is beautiful. Yeah. And then all these pieces that we see here, these are also similar idea of you cut it so it fits together without needing nails. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. These are all pieces that I sort of, you know, laid out and cut ahead of time. And then I bring it to the site and everything just kind of gets put together like Legos. I don't know, for a lack of a better term, you know, it just kind of all slots into the places that it's designed to slot into.
That's amazing. That's so beautiful. And then in the same series of extra projects, you had this beautiful wood. This is naturally aged wood, it looks like. Mm-hmm. I love seeing this and all the variation in color. Was this upcycled or reused wood? I know that you reuse a lot of wood in your projects, right?
Yeah, I mean, a majority of the materials that I use in my projects is recovered from other places that are being dismantled or torn down or whatever the case may be. And this particular wood came from a temple that was on the island that I tried for many years to stop the demolition of, not just myself, a group of us were really involved in trying to get it stop the demolition of, but in the end we failed, unfortunately. But I was able to go in before the demolition and recover, you know, as much usable material as I was able to, and got these nice old floorboards from there. And I've been using them in a number of different projects.
Oh, that's lovely. And you also mentioned that now you have a storage space, so it's easier to keep your materials and your tools and everything, right?
Yeah, I've got several storage spaces now across the island. This is one that I bought maybe 2 years ago, a year and a half or two now, and I'm getting sort of organized with all of my materials and a space there. This was really important for me, a really nice dedicated space to do the sharpening of tools. It's so convenient to have that, you know, a place that you can have ready and just sharpen whenever you need to have it set up.
It's so important for chefs to sharpen your knives, but for carpenters and builders, you have to sharpen your tools, right?
Yeah. And especially out here on the island, there's like a sea breeze all the time. So there's constantly salt in the air. And so tools go rusty in no time. I mean, if you leave a tool out overnight, you come back the next day and it's, you know, there's rust on it. It's continually frustrating.
Wow, that's really fast. Mm-hmm. Now, in the same project, the house and the deck, you also did these beautiful sinks. Is that right?
This is in a different house, but kind of projects that I'm all doing sort of at the same time. So, yeah, this is another one that the owners asked me to redo the sinks. And then there's a kitchen area where I put in some new countertops. And again, using old floorboards here. These floorboards came out of, they didn't come from the temple. They came from another old house that was being dismantled, but probably about the same age. And just another good way to reuse those materials. Yeah, that's my personal kitchen space. And I recently redid the kitchen sink area in there, again, using the same, these are the floor tiles from the temple. Over there, it was just sort of an old concrete sink that was all pitted and had sort of poor drainage and was really hard to use, actually. And so it's become really a pleasant area to make food now.
That's so nice. And it must feel great reusing wonderful wood that you've salvaged from somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can't get that character out of new wood, and then just the sustainability, I guess, that comes with not having to, you know, to cut down new trees. You can reuse this material, which is often much nicer than the material that you can even get new these days. You know, there's often a tighter grain. It's really well seasoned. You know, it's had 150 years to season in place, and so it doesn't, you know, have the same kind of shrinking and contraction to the same extent maybe as it would if it was new material. So yeah, lots of advantages to it. But there's also nails and this, what I was finding with this old floorboards is that a lot of it was handmade, and so the thicknesses are all a little bit different, and the tongue and groove that's cut there was made by hand, and so there's thinner parts and thicker parts, and sometimes it's hard to get it to, you know, to fit back together the way you want it to, because somebody was probably intentionally fitting these two pieces together, and if you aren't trying to put those exact same pieces together in the same way, sometimes they don't want to, you know, they don't want to go together. So it can be a bit more work as well to get that, to use it in a project.
It looked like you rebuilt a section of a roof. Is that right? This one?
Yeah. That exterior panel of the roof there, it had been kind of rotting away. And after a number of typhoons, which often pass by here on the island. Yeah. There you can see kind of, it's definitely, especially at the bottom where the rain hits it and kind of runs down, that bottom piece was kind of rotting away, and I replaced that section. It's always fun to be up on a roof, and that was like right in the fall. Fall in Ojika on the island is a beautiful season, so nice time to be up on the roof doing some work in some beautiful weather.
That looks beautiful. So you're finding that the wood is kind of deteriorating faster because of where you are?
I mean, wood here definitely deteriorates fast. Yeah, there's I mean, the typhoons that come through and cover everything with salt and just the wind and, you know, general damage that comes with a typhoon really takes a toll on buildings, and as part of a way to deal with that here is all of the traditional houses here have a wood siding covering everything. There usually isn't a section where it's just, you know, bare earth wall or plaster, you know, where you see in other areas where there isn't quite the typhoon action, like up in Okayama and stuff. A lot of the houses are just done to the nakanuri, just to the sort of middle earth finish. But here, I think with the typhoons, that would just all get washed away really quickly. But yeah, it's still, it takes a toll on the wood, and then just the general moisture of being damp a lot of the time with sort of ocean humidity also invites a lot of insect damage. So termites are really prevalent out here, and I spend a lot of my time fixing and dealing with termite damaged sections of the houses.
I've heard you talk about that a few times, of reaching up through a beam and hand going right through and knowing that
yeah.
you gotta replace that whole thing. That must be a horrible feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But it, you know, it's a common, that's just sort of something that you are always prepared to see out here. Yeah. It's unusual to go into a house and not have massive termite damage.
Is there a traditional approach to termite damage or termite resistant building
than
using pesticides?
Yeah, for sure. Keeping things dry is number one. So keeping up on your roof repair, you know, if you've got any leaks where there's water coming in, then so termites need moisture. They need a source of water to survive. So if you keep the area under and around your house dry, then it's a very difficult environment for termites to live in. And then increasing airflow. So traditionally the houses here would have, you know, sort of open underfloor areas, and the wind would be able to go under the floor and keep things again dry and sort of ventilated. But over the years, people sort of boarded up around the base, or maybe they even sometimes put a cement wall around the bottom. And then what I often find is that people, when they re-roof their house, they redo the roof tiles, a lot of times they put the old tiles under the floorboards. I guess just sometimes to have spares, and others just probably they didn't have that was the easiest place to sort of dispose of them or get rid of them at the time. But unfortunately, that also creates this sort of stagnated, moist air under the floorboards. And that's oftentimes where I see a lot of the damage coming in.
That's interesting. I've heard the same thing about if you have water under the house, you're going to have more centipedes and other not so nice insects in your house.
Yeah, I think insects in general like that sort of damp, damp, dark area.
That makes sense. Let's talk about Mura House. Was that a project you did on the island?
It's an in-progress project. Yeah, I've been doing the sort of the cleanup phase of that one for a while. It was full of lots of trash. So it's been an ongoing cleanup process. But it's a really sort of rare kominka in that it's a very compact size, and so one that I think a lot of people look for when they're looking for a kominka in Japan, but it's hard to find because so many of the kominka of older days were housing large families. But this is just sort of a one-story compact kominka, so really, really nice opportunity, I think, and should be a really cool little house when it's finally all finished up.
When you salvage the tiles like we're seeing here, do you use it in gardens, like for edging around the garden or different kinds of projects?
I use it in a few different ways. It can be useful for infilling anything that needs that you need bulk for, whether you can be making an earth wall or I think maybe I sent some photos of an earth oven that we built, and we used a lot of like crushed tiles to create a foundation for doing that. A lot of times they'll be used in sort of traditional earth walls, again, to add filler and just add design. Sometimes I just go in and crush it and then use it as like a You can even buy it, I think, at home centers, like crushed tile for like paving stone or not paving stone. What would I like garden stone in an approach to your house or an approach to the garden where it's kind of crushed up and just used as a decorative.
Kind of like gravel on the way up to the drive or something. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I use it where I can, but again, there's so much of it coming out that there's more than I can handle.
What are we looking at here? Is this just like the underneath or things that are composting, basically, biodegrading?
That's stuff that I after I cleaned out the first floor of the house, now I'm going up into the second story and like pulling stuff down that was in storage from the sort of under roof storage area. And there's just old, straw mats of all kinds and literally bundles of straw, rope. There were huge quantities of rope because being an island, this was a fisherman's, well, it was a carpenter's house, but everybody kind of is involved in fishing also in some, you know, to some capacity. So there's big, thick ropes that were used for tying up boats and, just incredible, all sorts of things that you find coming out of the, every nook and cranny of the house.
And last time we talked, you talked about taking down the plaster from old walls and reusing that plaster. Mm-hmm. And that if you reuse the old plaster, sometimes it's easier because you don't need to ferment the mix. Is that right?
Yeah, I generally do a short fermentation time, but, you know, usually leaving it for like a week or two. You don't even really need to necessarily leave it that long, but I put some fresh straw in it. Kind of a quick ferment. Well, the original material was often fermented for much, much longer, depending on the particular craft. You know, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 6 months. Some people would do it up to a year. Just kind of depended on that person's personal philosophy about things and the materials that they were using.
And then in the old houses, one of the things that John Stollenmeyer said when I saw his place as well is that you cannot find these beautiful curved beams anymore. So these are very valuable. Were you excited when you saw those beams?
Yeah, they're gorgeous. The beams in the houses here on Ojika, these black pine beams and the beautiful shapes that come with these pine trees are... they're gorgeous. And unfortunately, it's not something that you can get anymore. The pine trees on Ojika have mostly all died out. There's a few of them left, but as has happened across most of Japan, there's this, there's this kind of nematode that gets in the pine trees and kills them. And we've had that same thing happening here. So there's... you just really can't get those beams anymore.
So beautiful to see. Such a big job, but it must be so satisfying when you're working through things and keeping what can be preserved and then replacing things that need to be fixed, right?
Yeah, it's, part of the thing that I like about doing this work is that it's so... It has such a variety of different components to it. The cleanup obviously is one of the harder tasks, but after the cleanup comes a different type of work. You know, you maybe are fixing something carpentry related. I might be on the roof. I might be, like you say, doing something with the earth wall, making the bamboo frame for it or whatever. So it's always kind of a different, there are so many different aspects or different parts of it that are involved in the whole process of taking a house that was in this kind of condition and filled with trash and making it into a beautiful livable space again, that it's really, really rewarding to be able to go through that whole process and sort of have hands-on experience with every step of it.
The This is something I talked with Danny Benton about their projects with old houses in Omishima, dealing with all the trash. Mm-hmm. How easy or how difficult is it for you to get rid of all the trash, sort mm-hmm. it properly, recycle what you can, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it can be quite difficult depending on what the material is, how much of it there is. And then for people who are in different parts of Japan, there's different rules and different ways of dealing with materials depending on the local area that you're in. The island that I'm on now, the incinerator has been shut down and all of the trash is being sent to a different island. The burnable trash gets sent to a different island. And so like futons and those large bulky items that I used to be able to take out and bring directly to the incinerator, if they were beyond reusable condition or whatever, now they all have to be packed into the 45 liter garbage bag, even if it's a big futon. So it means that I have to go and cut these things into pieces and pack them into bags, and it adds to the labor that's involved quite a bit. And then I think there was one photo maybe that I showed that I did some asbestos removal work, which is something that I would love to I wish that could be like a topic at the Minka Summit or something. Is it's something that I want people to have more awareness about, because I see so many people doing these DIY projects and just going in with masks or improper safety gear and just knocking down these walls that I guarantee have asbestos in them. I mean, there's this time frame in Japan and around the world where just about every construction material that was made at that time had asbestos in it. And it's something that people need to be aware of. How do you deal with, how do you deal with it safely? How do you get rid of it? There's a lot of stuff involved with that. So that's something that can be a...
Wow, that's a really important topic. Yeah. Is there something you look for that's definitely, that's asbestos? Is there some key, or would you recommend people Google it to see what it looks like? Or
I mean, there is a database. It's in Japanese, but there is a database where if you know the product name and the manufacturer, you can look up whether it contained asbestos. So it'll tell you like the dates that this product contained asbestos. And in Japan, the products contained asbestos up until 2006, certain products. So even quite recently built homes are still at danger of having asbestos in the sheetrock and in fireproof wallboard and stuff. Even quite recently it had it. So if you're lucky enough to know like the manufacturer and the date that it was roughly installed, you can kind of look that up. But otherwise it for me it's just been doing a lot of research online and finding what material had asbestos and roughly the dates. And then at this point I've sort of interacted with enough of those materials that I can identify a suspect material, pretty quickly, whether it's, a lot of the sort of acoustic ceiling tiles that you might find in kitchens a lot of times would have had asbestos. And then that sort of wall board, plaster board, and especially that fireproof board that you would find in the kitchen or around a fireplace. Place is often a culprit, but all sorts of materials, had asbestos in it. So even the like little cooking stoves, or if you have an old like boiler for your bath, to the hot water boiler, it had an insulative material around there, probably near the chimney somewhere, and oftentimes that is loaded with asbestos. So lots of places that you need to keep an eye out. Yeah, before you just sort of go pulling things apart without any protection.
And were you able to get protective gear? Were you able to get rid of it properly with the authorities? Like once you knew what it was that an easy process?
I removed it in with all of my, like the appropriate protocols, fully masked, fully suited, double bagged, you know, keeping the area sort of quarantined off and removing it and then sealing the double bags and bringing it to the disposal location. Unfortunately, the disposal location on Ojika, although they accept asbestos containing wall boards, they wanted it to be in just like a regular sort of, it's called a donobukuro. It's just like a cheap old plastic bag that you usually put dirt in, and it's all leaky and whatever. And so they wanted originally me to cut open my double sealed asbestos bags and transfer them into these leaky whatever things. And of course the people working there have no masks or no protection whatsoever. So I said, you know what, like it's the same size as that donobukuro, so I'm just going to leave it here. If you want to cut it open and put it in those bags, like I'm telling you right now, this has asbestos. It's in the proper labeled, you know, asbestos bags. Do not open. So I'm like, I don't think you do that, but you know, like I've properly cured it for you. And from here on out, it's in your hands, I guess. And unfortunately on the island here, that's sort of the only option available.
Wow. Yeah. That is crazy. Let's talk about, you mentioned the pizza oven. Let's talk about Olya, the artist in the island. Tell me about that project. Was that a collaboration?
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. She's originally from Moldova and now does work in Amsterdam and Paris, but came over on a program that's called Artist in Island. And there have been a number of artists that have come over in the last couple of years. But she was one that wanted to do a lot of sort of hands-on building work and using a lot of recycled, reused materials. And so I got involved with her, and basically we spent a couple months working just about every day together, building, this earth oven, and building the earth pizza oven, all with recycled materials, obviously. Earth from walls were dismantled from houses on the island, and those stones came from an old irori in an old house that had been dismantled, so the stones from that. Yeah, and then we built this simple sort of Japanese style hut where I kind of taught her some simple joinery, and she did all of the cutting and fitting basically herself, and then we put it up and did the earth walls and put a simple bamboo roof on it, and made a fun little structure, stomping the new straw into the earth with our feet.
That's lovely. Did you ferment this before you put it in the wall, like leave it for a while?
Set it for a little while. Also in the middle of winter, so doing sort of a proper fermentation. But yeah, you can see here she's
joinery, is it?
Joinery work, yep.
That's wonderful. What a great collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun. And then we had kind of a community pizza party once everything was finished and people came over, and we fired up the oven there, and everyone had a chance to make, you know, put the toppings on the pizza that they wanted and cook a pizza in there. And then Olya also had some of her other, she does photography and also some work with clay. And so she had other art pieces on display there that she had prepared for the event and done over the course of her stay there, including a cookbook that she put together with recipes from people in the community.
Oh, that's awesome. That's definitely when we talk to places that want to revitalize the rural area, we always say, have you invited artists to come and live there and be a part of your community? Because the artist's perspective is such a vibrant, interesting draw, right? Mm-hmm. For residents and visitors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it creates an insight, an exciting, an interesting atmosphere for people who are already here and don't maybe have an opportunity to see, art firsthand very often. And then it also creates an opportunity for other artists to come in and see that artwork or maybe collaborate with other artists. And yeah, it's a great opportunity. And it seems like it's in the years going forward, it's going to be getting even more sort of active here on that one. There's been a number of actually old houses now that I've been in conversation with some of these artist groups to be involved with sort of fixing them up so that they can have spaces to do projects in.
That's so nice. And I'm sure you see a lot of examples where renovations of houses is done kind of with a more creative approach. You don't have to rebuild exactly like it was. You can add insulation, for example. You can add solar panels, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the creative approach is really important, right?
Mm. Yeah, thinking a little bit outside the usual the usual box.
Absolutely. Now this one you called Nagano House. Is it actually in Nagano?
Yeah, in Nagano. It's a place that I am in the process of trying to work through the difficulties of moving it to putting it in my name. It's been probably 3.5 years or so that I've been going through the process of trying to get it into my name. And we're kind of in the last little steps of getting that done.
So are your chickens as well?
They're actually the neighbors' chickens. There's some lovely neighbors, a couple in their 30s that moved there from Tokyo into another empty kominka there. And they have some chickens that always come and visit in the morning. So it's a little shadier over at my place. And I think they like to come and hang out under the shade trees and eat the bugs.
Now it's got a metal cover, but it looks like it's a thatch roof. Are you going to restore that?
Yeah, it's a really gorgeous, deep, deep thatch roof. I mean, probably a meter thick of thatch and really deep eaves. So I'm really excited to, at some point I'll be pulling the metal cover off and putting it back to thatch. And those neighbors that I mentioned earlier are also of the same mind. They want to do the same thing. So hopefully we'll have a pair of them there. And then between the two of us, we'll have basically this sort of the mountainside that goes up behind the houses. And we've also been in talks to sort of turn that into a thatch patch, I guess, so that we can grow thatch that we need to use for our roofing and maybe, you know, if other people also want to kind of get involved in that, that could be something that we also do workshops or, whatever happens. But I think it's a good way to sort of utilize that land space behind the houses right now that used to be used for farming and things, but currently is just sort of sitting empty.
Yeah, I've heard that a few places that want to redo the thatch, the first step is you got to grow the right straw for the thatch, right? Mm-hmm. it's obvious, but it's something a lot of people wouldn't think about, right?
And it's one of the biggest costs in rethatching a roof is to actually, if you were to buy all of that thatch, it's quite expensive because it's very labor intensive to grow and cut and store and do all of that work.
You've also been making charcoal. Tell us about charcoal making.
Yeah, I do all of my cooking and basically all of my heating here on the island, which it doesn't ever really get super cold. So that's not a big aspect of things. But in my horikotatsu, I heat it with charcoal. But all of my cooking happens on a little shichirin, a little charcoal fired burner type thing here. And I go and make charcoal every year and make a year's worth of charcoal over a couple of weeks and then bring it back here to the island. The actual kiln is on a friend's property on the next island over. But basically, yeah, I can make a year's worth of charcoal, like one year's worth of cooking energy for myself from one medium-sized tree. Because when you change the wood into charcoal, the efficiency of that fuel becomes greatly increased. Yeah, so an entire year of cooking with one sort of medium-sized tree. So it's a very, it's not something that you need to cut down a large swath of the forest. It's a very sustainable way of creating a fuel that you use, but not using much of the forest resources it should be able to regenerate as much, wood in that forest, much more actually than if you're just alone like myself, then you're actually taking out of the forest.
Do you follow the principles that the traditional architects and builders would do when they take trees from the forest? You try to plant trees for the next 200 years, that kind of philosophy. I love that idea.
Yeah, we don't really plant trees there because, I mean, part of it is that we're taking so few, and actually the area that we're taking trees from is quite dense, packed with trees already. And part of the idea is that we're trying to get it back into a situation where the forest is a little, what would I say? Like more of the species are good for making charcoal with. And like right now there's a whole bunch of sea planted around there and yeah, obviously we don't want, I mean, that's not something that we're making charcoal with. The charcoal that the wood that makes really good charcoal here is the camellia wood. Makes for really, really nice, hard, long burning charcoal. But at the sort of scale that we're doing it here, the forest naturally is reseeding and regenerating at a rate that there's not even actually really like room to replant. Anything that would replant there would already be overgrown by the natural regeneration of the forest.
There's a lot of forests like that just need thinning. We need to make use of our domestic wood more. So that's great that you're actually helping the forest stay healthy in that way too, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Just going back to some of the interesting points from last time we talked, strange things you found on projects. Mm-hmm. Strange things you found in the last 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, I continue to find skeletons of various things, usually up in the under the roof space. That's sort of a constant. It seems like every house that I go into, at some point during the process, I'm going to find a skeleton of something somewhere. So
I guess it's better than a live snake or something. Do you have snakes on the island?
Oh, I find live snakes quite a bit though. And that's a good one. I actually, in one house that I dismantled, it had gotten too far gone to actually be restored. So I took it apart and I cut through the main roof beam. It's called the Ushi body. It's a really, really thick curved beam that supports the main load of the roof. I cut through an area that had been eaten out by termites, so it was mostly hollow. Inside that hollow, there had obviously been a snake like making it its residence. It was full of the discarded snake skin inside of this termite hollowed section of the roof beam. So that was quite a a shock to like be cutting through and having snake skin like falling out of the hole as I'm pulling this beam apart.
Oh my gosh, that sounds... Did you see the snake?
I didn't see that snake, but where I most often find them is under roof tiles. So when I'm pulling roof tiles apart, especially on the roofs that have earth under the tile, they like to make little just little spots, because there's also going to be food for them there. There's often rodents and things that make their homes in that area. You know, the rodents will create a little nest and the snake will seek out the rodent, and it kind of creates a little community up there. Yeah, but the snake
is considered quite... Before you break in to let them know that you're coming?
Oh, yeah. I do a little... a little tapping to try and reduce the amount of surprises that I get as I'm sometimes standing in precarious footing, and then to have a snake sort of pop out from under a roof tile can be a little a little surprising.
And a question I asked you 2 years ago, and I'd love to ask you again: are you still enjoying it? Are you still enjoying the work you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. More and more so, probably every time, especially now with that Nagano house. I'm excited to sort of try working it. It's a very different type of house, and it's constructed very differently. You know, the mountains of Nagano are very different from the island style houses here in southwestern Japan. So the roof is, you know, a totally different material. The joinery that's being used up there, especially in the beams that are connecting the columns with the roof, are totally different joinery, different materials. So yeah, I'm really excited to be able to learn how things were done in, you know, sort of a different area.
That's wonderful. We have just a few more minutes. Is there anything we haven't touched on? Tell us a little bit about your philosophy for your business or going forward. Any new projects coming up?
Yeah, I think going forward, I mean, my philosophy continues to be trying to take places that are not in livable condition and make them into livable places for people to move into the community from, you know, generally it's people moving from outside of the community. So trying to revitalize some of these places by making opportunities for people to live there. And I think going forward, it's just sort of an expansion on that, you know, trying it in a different a place. In Nagano, I'll be doing it, but also other places still here on Ojika. And then, yeah, looking forward over the next couple of years, I've been getting a number of requests from people to sort of apprentice with me, and it's something that I've been thinking about, but I haven't really felt quite ready to sort of take on that responsibility, but I'm feeling like it will I'll be at that point in maybe in the next 2 years. I feel like it'll be in that area, so maybe also bringing on some new people to do these projects together with is kind of something that I see as an expansion into the future.
That would be really exciting. And that's something that Emily touched on as well, about the difficulty of finding an apprenticeship, of finding someone who would take on an apprentice. So if you're ready to pass on some of your knowledge, I'm sure there'll be a lot of takers. That's really exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited. I also think I feel like I have to be ready, because it's a big, you know, I don't want to do it until I'm ready to create a good opportunity for someone that, you know, they're going to have a good experience and get a lot out of it. So getting the preparations ready for that.
Yeah, wonderful. We had a great comment from Louise. Nice to see you. And Epiphany London, great discussion. Also loving the visible mending on Brett's sweater, the reuse of your sweater that you've got on.
Mm. Oh, sorry.
Your sweater right now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the feed like froze just for a second, I think.
Is it okay?
I didn't hear what the comment was, but I guess it's about the sweater, which...
How
yeah,
about your mended sweater is beautiful.
Thanks to Guchan for doing this, yeah, mending of the sweater for me.
you're reusing even what you wear, not only old houses, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Brett, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Minka Summit.
Yeah, thanks. I'm looking forward to seeing you as well. It'll be a good time.
Wonderful. And thanks, everyone, for joining. And we'll see you next time. Take care. Streaming it.